Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, May 14th, 2011. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. I want to begin with a message from Lyndon LaRouche to our listeners. He was commenting yesterday on the worsening crises, which we will be discussing on the program today. On the one side, the deepening financial economic crash, which is spreading desperation among normal people, and panic among bankers because it's out of control, especially in Europe, but even in the United States, we're seeing a whole series of factors which are pointing toward the hyperinflationary collapse that Mr. LaRouche has been warning about. And then secondly, the worsening crisis from so-called natural disasters. The ones most immediately impinging on us are the devastating floods now hitting the Midwestern and Southern states of the United States. So in speaking of these crises to his associates, Mr. LaRouche said the following, and when I say his associates, I'm including you, the listeners of this program. Here's the quote from Lyndon LaRouche. Without Glass-Steagall, there's no remedy for any of this. Therefore, the Glass-Steagall pressure has to be on. Anybody who is not for Glass-Steagall is either insane or incompetent. Your life depends on the passage of the Glass-Steagall bill now. It's an emergency. They have to pass Glass-Steagall now. It's the only thing that will prevent mass death of people in the United States among the obvious vulnerable categories, including the slaughter of senior citizens on medical care. The Glass-Steagall Act, if implemented, would immediately create a fundamental difference in the flow of funds. Without Glass-Steagall, the United States is going to die. And those who are not voting for Glass-Steagall are voting for the death of the United States. Now, I'm going to continue. This is comments from Lyndon LaRouche from yesterday. Let the banks go bankrupt. We've got to save the people. Banks we can create. We can create banks in great numbers anytime. Whenever you want a bank, we can create them. So get rid of these banks. We'll cancel the bailout and shut these banks down because they cannot qualify under the Glass-Steagall standard. We can always create new banks. Under Glass-Steagall, we can take emergency action to save the parts of the banks that are viable. And that will save the nation. Anybody else with a different program is an idiot. That's what we're going to say. We're not going to pussyfoot anymore. But we can take care of these things. Glass-Steagall, get Glass-Steagall through. It's simple. Now, that's what Lyndon LaRouche had to say yesterday, and I think it's fairly clear that he's calling for the passage as soon as possible of the bill from Marcy Kaptur, which added several new co-sponsors this week, H.R. 1489. Now, let me add one thing to this message. To get Glass-Steagall will take an active, aggressive mobilization from you, our listeners. Don't think there's some magic bullet with a simple pathway or a courageous congressman or two out there who will push this through. We, the people of the United States of America, must act as citizens of a republic to save our nation by going back to the constitutional principle which Glass-Steagall represents. We must make sure that this bill, H.R. 1489, is rammed through. So don't try to come up with some simple suggestion. And on the other hand, don't give up. We can win this fight, but you have to act as leaders. We have an example I'll just report to you briefly from Portland, Oregon, from Multnomah County, where a longtime supporter of LaRouche PAC organized a group of fellow members of the county Democratic executive, drafted a resolution for Glass-Steagall, and had it passed this week through their executive council. So now the Democratic Party in the largest city of Oregon is on record as supporting this bill, and they're going to go out and organize the congressmen in that area to support it. Now, on our program today, I'll be interviewing my co-host of the LaRouche Show in somewhat unconventional manner, Marcia Mary Baker, who is an expert on the necessary platform, which is sometimes erroneously called infrastructure. needed to deal with disasters such as the ongoing flooding along the Mississippi and the Ohio. And also joining us from LPAC TV editorial team is Spencer Cross. And I want to ask our listeners, if you have some questions for the panel or for me, get them in early. Send them to radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio@larouchepub.com. So, Marcia and Spencer, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thanks. Hi, Harley.
Hi, Marcia. Why don't we begin by getting the picture from you of the disaster with the floods that are now coursing toward the Gulf of Mexico and taking a lot of farmland and other things with them.
Well, let's start with the breaking news, even during the hour in which we're speaking, in terms of the fact that the crest in the Mississippi has reached the high water mark near down at the beginning of the Delta, a place called Red Landing, where as of 3:30 Eastern time during our show, the Army Corps of Engineers commander there, Colonel Fleming, is giving a press conference, and just as our show concludes today at 4 o'clock, they'll start to open the first gates of the spillway called the Morganza Spillway, built in 1931, which was never used except for one time in 1973, but has been there due to foresight all this time, to start to siphon off some of this high Mississippi River flow down into the Atchafalaya Basin, direct into the Gulf of Mexico, to spare the downriver concentrations, New Orleans, Baton Rouge, and so forth. So that kind of news event implies certain things. One thing is this: the massive flow of the massive runoff that we've been seeing in the Mississippi River, which, by the way, if you take all the rivers that feed into it, it's the third biggest catchment area of a river system in the world. There's the Congo, the Amazon, and there's the Mississippi, including the Missouri, including the Ohio. And by the way, remember, the Tennessee River flows into the Ohio and then at Paducah, Kentucky, into the later downriver goes into the Mississippi. So,
Marcia, let me just ask you, if this spillway is not opened, what would happen?
Worse than Katrina. In other words, inundation completely is
for New Orleans.
Exactly. I'm sorry, for New Orleans, because of course Katrina, hit the Mississippi coast and with flood surge and sea surge, wave surge, and so forth. But in other words, yes, this is expected to work, Harley. It's not. It doesn't mean there won't be flooding there and other points downriver and upriver from this. There is flooding, as you well know. But this is one of the three biggest spill floodways, diversion channels, mm-hmm. that have been in place for decades for such an extreme situation as we have on our hands now. People may know from following it that a big floodway was opened just where the Ohio and Mississippi meet. It's called Bird's Point. The levee was breached. It's called Bird's Point, and there's a floodway called Bird's Point, New Madrid. And the water just goes through a part of eastern Missouri before it goes back in the Mississippi. And then another one just upriver from the one that's opening now in about 45 minutes is the famous Bonacari. It was built in the 1950s. And about 200 and some of the gates of its total 300 and some gates on that spillway are currently open, and they're doing their job. That water is flowing into Lake Pontchartrain and avoiding New Orleans. It's going out to Gulf of Mexico to the east. So what we've got here, let me just say two things now by way of overview. What we've got here is a system of, we mentioned floodways. You know there are levees on the Mississippi and on the Ohio and related rivers. So we've got a system that of flood control that involves those two kinds of features, diversion channels and levees. It also involves the fact that the Army Corps has been committed to keep the main channel of the Mississippi and Ohio River dredged, because that's good for navigation stability and also for floods. And finally, there's the upper systems of what feeds into these big rivers. There's the White River in Arkansas. We could go down at St. Francis River, the Red River. We can mention many of them, but...
But you're saying that these systems that were put in place previously do function.
That's it, and they were... And look at the age, look at the time frame we're talking about. It was in after a big 1927 flood that there was an act passed by the federal government, Federal Control Act of 1928. They specified something, if you want to look it up, called the MRT Project, Mississippi River and Tributaries Project. And the idea was develop these four main features that we just described of structures and of activities like dredging, and be at the ready to prevent. They had huge damage. It lasted for months in 1927 to prevent that kind of thing. And in 1956, after the Second World War, when after the war was fought, people were then saying, okay, now what should we do? They revamped it, added some more things, and mostly, and every single structure that they did and were able to keep up worked. But in recent years, certainly the Obama and before him the George W. Bush administration, and before that, there's been an undercutting of the maintenance of this system, and there certainly has been an onslaught against the outlook that you should have a system. The environmentalists, that we can get into that if we want to, pseudo-environmentalists are saying you shouldn't be interfering with nature, so-called, at all. So, as I say, we can get back to that. But these systems work. The issue is the upper Mississippi, not from Cairo downward, not from Illinois downward, but up to the north, Iowa, Minnesota, and so forth, that was hit by environmentalists and never fully developed the way this southern system was. So we had the famous Lake Iowa once. We had that area terrifically flooded because it's lacking a lot of the diversions and other installations you could use.
Well, Marcia, the other question then, just to set the stage for the discussion, is that there has been an effort by some of these governors of the southern states to get more federal help to deal with the flooding, and both with the Army Corps and also with emergency help. And I, from what we've been reporting, that has not been forthcoming from the administration.
That is, it's widespread and it's severe. In other words, Mr. LaRouche has done, and it's the Haiti treatment for the United States. Instead of moving in Haiti with the Army Corps, which had literally in the past, its Mobile division had done studies of what you need in Haiti in the way of lakes, water management, sanitation, flood control. Nothing was done, thanks to the White House not or nixing doing anything. Mm-hmm. And here in this, what we have, Harley, is in the flood zone I'm just describing, also you know the famous tornado belt zone.
Right. Right.
And then you may be speaking to us from California, but being as you're in Texas, you know the terrific drought zone in Texas and other states, including...
Well, Marcia, I also just recently was standing on the hill in Vicksburg, Mississippi, overlooking the Mississippi at that area, which is now flooded, and I was driving through Clinton, Mississippi when the tornadoes hit. So I may be a walking disaster zone myself.
Well, that exemplifies it in this sense. Let me just say one thing. The Obama administration is doing a kind of disaster as usual, go through the motions. Governors are appealing, rightly, for disaster relief designation. You know, going through what you need to have an official federal approval of saying this count, these many counties, this is a disaster. Texas is doing that for its fire and drought counties. And people may be more aware of Alabama with Tuscaloosa and everything else in the tornado counties. But the White House has been selectively disapproving a lot of that. Where they do approve it, they're only making places eligible for loans. That means just the towns and counties that weren't even able over the last couple of years to keep the normal workforce at work. Their police, fire, trash removal, public health. How are they going to pay any loans? They don't have any revenue anyway. So that characterizes the the mockery that's taking place in the United States, which is the Haiti treatment of these
now,
disaster
areas.
Now,
let me bring Spencer in at this point, because one of the things that LaRouche PAC Television has been tasked with by Mr. LaRouche is doing a series of videos, including the galactic effects that cause some of these disasters, including earthquakes and tornadoes and so on, to develop this point of the Haiti treatment, that the American people are being left essentially defenseless in the face of this kind of clearly escalated onslaught of so-called natural events. Spencer, why don't you give us a sense of what we've been doing with LPAC TV to address this?
Yeah, well, we've had just over the last week and a half, 2 weeks, a series of videos highlighting these potential disaster areas in around the United States, in areas that we know and have known for some time that are ripe for potential disasters, whether they be earthquakes or a combination of earthquakes and tsunamis and volcanoes. People can watch the latest one on the San Francisco Bay Area. It was very good. And we're going to have another one on the Cascadia Subduction Zone, which I'm familiar with because I grew up in the Northwest. And it's funny growing up there because the discussion is always, oh, yes, you know, we had Mount St. Helens in 1980, but Mount Rainier is going to blow any day. And that's the larger point, you know, we've been raising with this question of the Rim of Fire and the galactic question. You know, Cody Jones just released a video this morning on this galactic crisis where mankind's in a much larger process than, you know, 4 years of Obama, which is its own form of natural disaster. But
bad enough.
Bad enough. We need some disaster relief from Obama right now. But the galactic question, the fact that we've had five major extinctions on the Earth, these are processes that are becoming increasingly knowable to mankind. And it's not as simple as to say that we're in the exact same conditions as those previous extinctions. We are in very similar conditions. But the fact being that no steps of preparation are being undertaken from the U.S. government. Obama's made it very clear that he's not concerned with, as was clear with Haiti. And we could maybe talk about that, but we've had a historic relationship with Haiti. Alexander Hamilton helped write the Haiti Constitution back in the 1790s, and normally under our better leadership in our country, we go and we aid these nations. We help them develop, but we also help them with relief when we need. And that's not happening in the case of the states now, with as Marsha was describing in the Mississippi River. So that's what we're looking at, and we've been covering it from that idea that, you know, one, we do need to develop these better apparatuses for being able to sense the disasters. We need to do the immediate steps to rebuild these areas, as we have in our better times. But they all hinge on getting this real fascist of a president out and Glass-Steagall immediately as the first step.
Now, just as we're talking about this question of the aid, some people say, well, the president has no choice, there's no money. You look at one of the ironies here, Governor Jindal of Louisiana, who I think turned down some of the stimulus funds, who's a fiscal conservative, an austerity monger, typical hardcore right-wing Republican. Now that the crisis is hitting, he's asking for aid, and what he's getting back from Obama is the same kind of fascist response that you get from Rand Paul and the other Republicans who say, look, federal government can't take care of these things. How does the Glass-Steagall address this crisis? Because I want to have an interweaving of this discussion of, you know, that we're not helpless. We have ways to deal with it, as Marsha will give us increasingly during the program. But how does Glass-Steagall change this, Spencer?
Well, the first thing is it gets us away from this completely evil idea that we have no control, that this is, you know, this as you're, the point you're raising, there's this discussion from the hard right wing in the United States and Obama, which believes exactly the same idea that, you know, we have to just make the cuts. We have to make the hard cuts. We're forced to. There's nothing we can do. And beyond just the cuts themselves, but that like theological, philosophical idea is one of the most evil conceptions, to say that, well, no, we have to let people die because there's a budget that we have to conform to. And you say, well, who wrote the budget? Who do we owe the money to? You know, what's these banks? Half these banks don't even exist anymore. So who do we owe? And it's this without the Glass-Steagall, if living under that idea is just a purely evil notion, that we have to let people die to make sure some banks of, which is really bank sheets of worthless assets, we have to pay worthless assets back in order to not save human life. And that's the first thing that has to go. That's the fascist element that has no place in our country or in the human race.
That's the Austrian school creative destruction that maybe people shouldn't have built in these areas. People shouldn't live there. Mm-hmm. They have to take their own risk if they want to live there, that whole kind of free market idea.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And mind you, that's just the cover story for privilege. In other words, not that anyone presumes it would work. In other words, I won't be living there. You're the one that's going to die. Because look at the great New Orleans Delta. It's something that man has organized for there to be a city there. Look at all of the Netherlands. All of Holland is the Delta of the Rhine River. I mean, it's different from the Mississippi. It's much smaller. Same with the Nile River. All of Cairo, Egypt, you know, is a delta. So anyway, the creative destructionists just make up the some kind of construction to say you're going to die.
And this is the, if you look at the Obama policy, in a sense, he already said when he was in Alabama, we can't predict earthquakes, we can't predict tornadoes, but we can help clean up afterwards. But he's lying twice, because we can make forecasts, and he has no intention of cleaning up afterwards.
Right. On the cleanup, that's just, again, to underscore this mockery and of governors and county leaders, farm groups, appealing for aid. You have a situation where, of course, the any receding stormwater, you have that now in Georgia, the Carolinas, as well as Alabama and parts of eastern northern Mississippi. You have debris all over the place. You certainly could have we have the precedent for something like FDR's Works Projects Administration, which went into the Ohio Valley after a huge storm in the 30s. You could have AmeriCorps, they're using that in Georgia somewhat, that's a national program. You have all the physical and human capacity. It's just the financial issue that the White House and the agencies, Agriculture Department and the rest, are just not going to use. They're going to block.
Marcia, are there plans from the Army Corps of Engineers or the Agriculture Department on how to deal with these kinds of things, what it would take in terms of personnel, in terms of equipment to clean up?
Well, some of the ranks of the Army Corps of Engineers, well, one thing, there's wonderful precedent. After one of the most recent, after the big, most recent San Francisco earthquake, the Army Corps of Engineers went in there. They used private contract bidding as well as their own capacity. And much of the, some of the rebuilding was done in advance at a lower cost, because they offered a premium to, if you got the job done fast, so that you could ramp that up, you know, use that as a model. The Army Corps itself is only around 35,000 strong in the United States, when it was close to 50,000 some years past. So it and at least 10,000 of the 35,000 have been cycled and recycled through Iraq and Afghanistan. So they are way overstretched, and much of their planning capacity has been suppressed and not deployed because they weren't commissioned to do so. It was opposed by the combination of what you two have just discussed, the kind of right-wing, left-wing, liberal, fascist policy prevailing in Washington that hasn't commissioned these kinds of studies. But it can be done. They know how to do it. And you could have this very extended team of CCC, AmeriCorps-type forces, State National Guard, mm-hmm. Army Corps with leadership and engineering capacity, state engineering capacity, and there's even residual left in the U.S. Agriculture Department They have their soil conservation. It's now called National Resources Conservation Division. They control thousands in these flood zones of the smaller upper watershed dams.
Mm-hmm.
And so they could collaborate. So it's exactly the question of the radical shift in policy direction that Spencer just implied in going for Glass-Steagall and getting rid of this evil principle that you have to be subject to destruction and death. Not at all. So that could be changed very quickly. The plans and the implementation could go like crazy.
All right, well, you're listening to The LaRouche Show. It is Saturday, May 14th, 2011. As you may have heard at the beginning, Marcia said there will be a dramatic announcement in just a few minutes, a press conference about the opening of the Morganza Spillway, which will hopefully spare both Baton Rouge and New Orleans. I mean, one of the ironies of Baton Rouge being on the flood target is that a lot of people who moved out of New Orleans after Katrina settled in Baton Rouge. I want to just urge our listeners to think about what we're saying from the standpoint of the call to action from Lyndon LaRouche, of getting the Glass-Steagall implemented so that we can shift the thinking away from money and saving money through budget cuts, even while we're bailing out corrupt swindlers who run the banks that created this crisis, and shifting it back to a credit system of the American system. And we have videos on this on the LaRouchePact.com website. And let me again give you our email address today. If you have any questions, you can send them to us at radio@larouchepub.com. Now, Spencer, I know you've done a lot of historical work, especially around Alexander Hamilton. Had you done some work on the whole question of the Army Corps of Engineers in West Point?
Not really, no.
Okay, Marcia, have you done
some work? No, one thing is speaking of Alexander Hamilton, the whole heritage, of course, of the current Army Corps of Engineers was that West Point trained everyone for a very long time. All commanders, all of the servicemen trained there were in engineering. Robert E. Lee was trained there. I guess he worked on levees down in the South. But they were all trained in it. Then, of course, it became more specialized. So that was the American system legacy that all of these commanders. So you deal with, let's just take, pull something out of the air. General Eisenhower, whom we know from the Second World War and from his presidency, it was under him that the Army Corps was deployed into Haiti to build their one and only and biggest dam that's a hydropower dam on the Artibonite or Artibonite River system. In other words, it was part of foreign policy, domestic policy, and this is the great engineering tradition that was established here from the best of Europe, from the Ecole Polytechnique.
That's the real nation-building tradition as opposed to the rhetoric of Dick Cheney and George Bush.
It used to be just the same concept. I mean, the Army Corps used to be seen, like, that was the purpose of the Army. The idea of nation-building and national defense were the same idea.
And, you know, you mentioned before, could we deploy and really move in to Alabama and to Tuscaloosa? And yes, including that the National Guard, remember, which is, you know, both military and civilian in a way, is part of our heritage, and so we could do the job. There's no question about it. And one thing that some of the advocates of the Army Corps of Engineers point out, meaning fighters, not just nostalgia advocates, but policy fighters. There's, for example, a fellow who's been a leader, who was a representative in Mississippi for 10 years in the 1990s, named Mike Parker. He's now in private life, private activity. But he was, over the 2001-2002 period, an assistant U.S. Army for the Army Corps of Engineers. He headed it up, okay? And he said, you know, anyway, he was forced to resign by George W. Bush because Mike Parker spoke out and said, you must fund the Army Corps of Engineers. Mm. And he said, and Parker has recently reiterated, if you funded it only like a couple of billion more a year in recent years, instead of stiffing it at $5 or $6 billion, if you funded it or $7 or $8 billion, you would have been doing the maintenance and construction and the studies for emergency deployment and so forth that you needed. But it's been stripped down. I mean, most recently, the Obama proposal currently, among many other things, it cuts of the Army Corps of Engineers, and this is supported by the right-wing nutcases in the Senate, is that he plans to cut by half the dredging money for the channels at Vicksburg and elsewhere. Well, that just invites silting up and more chaos should there be another flood.
Well, and the irony is that the same president has never said a word against the trillions of dollars going in as bailouts to J.P. Morgan Chase, Goldman Sachs, Deutsche Bank, BNP Paribas, somewhere between $17 and $24 trillion in bailout funds, and Parker's talking about $1 to $2 billion to protect life. I mean, Marcia, what I'd like you to also address now is the implications of this on food production, food availability, because we're talking about the heartland, the center of American agriculture, the most productive in the world, has been hit by these floods. At the same time, we're diverting whole sections of U.S. agriculture production to take food and burn it as a fuel, as a so-called environmentalist policy moving away from fossil fuels. So what does it look like in terms of the effects of the flooding for food production in the United States?
Well, this is dire, and it also comes when you don't, internationally, you know, we're way below threshold for producing enough food. So any hit worldwide hurts. And so you have one thing, you have the transportation artery, the Mississippi River itself. Navigation is presently shut. It's too dangerous. The Coast Guard makes that decision. And so all the barges and other traffic that haul in the fertilizer and the chemicals inputs to farming, that flow is disrupted. Anything being hauled out from storage is disrupted. The bulk, bringing out wheat and corn and other soybeans. That goes through New Orleans. That's disrupted. Then the fields itself, as you were just implying, which in eastern Missouri and a lot of places are flooded, even if they aren't on the Mississippi or aren't on the Ohio, you know, in southern Indiana, southern Illinois, there are fields standing underwater. And this is springtime. So
we're coming up toward a deadline for planting.
And I would say it's now in some of the mid-latitudes for corn. May 15th is often pointed to is when you want to have, as a nation, in your corn belt, you want to have most of your corn. And by the way, fortunately in Iowa, we do. It's amazing. The Extension Service points out that you have such gung-ho farmers and such an amount of machinery that you could probably plant the entire state. It's almost like one cornfield in 12 days. That's incredible. But a great deal of that's going to biofuels. And the other areas of the country which has some going to biofuels, like Kentucky, which has been hit by floods, anywhere you're producing soybeans, corn, or other crops, all of this counts in your national output. And the United States accounts for 35% to 40% of the entire world annual output of corn. So here we are talking about fields being in trouble. Even if it isn't Western Iowa in trouble, you have whatever fields there were in Mississippi, in Louisiana, in Missouri, in Kentucky, they are now damaged. So again, for what kind of federal leadership should a nation have? There should be on standby the maximum effort to go in and intervene and replant, clear the debris, check the field, provide the seeds. Don't just say, we'll give you a loan, don't get too depressed. No, give a grant and make it happen. But what's instead, the Farm Service Agency, that's the FSA it's called, is going in to the tornado states and elsewhere, and they'll say, well, we'll give you a percentage. We'll pay maximum 75% for you to help you rebuild your livestock or your catfish farms in Mississippi, when the person or the county or the state is completely devastated. So this is a joke. So this is a major this is a major hit. And Harley, let me say one thing. This may or may not be a segue, but apropos of looking at this in its planetary, solar, and galactic context, go outside the planet a minute and look down on our landmass called North America. We have, besides the drought zones, there's a lot of it's record rain that's been recorded in the Ohio Valley. Never before since written records have we had this much rain, 16, 17, 18 inches in the month of April. Likewise, up in the huge basin that's the Hudson Bay Basin in Canada, and mm-hmm. that takes you into the high prairie states, that takes you into the wheat belt up there.
Mm-hmm.
You know that they, this morning around 7 o'clock, they had to breach a levee northwest of Winnipeg in southern Manitoba on that big Assiniboine River that goes into the Red River that then flows into the Hudson Bay. They already are using a floodway, by the way, but that wasn't enough. They did have one to use. I think it's called the Portage Floodway. So there's the governor of Manitoba went on radio last night to say, to speak to the people saying, we're sorry, we tried to do this as last as possible to give you the maximum time if you live in the floodway to leave, but we have to save Winnipeg and the bigger cities. The engineers are calling it a flood of 300 years. Who knows, 200, 500. That brings us to just what Spencer was saying about the absolute need to know when it comes to Glass-Steagall, are we going to live or die? You have to look at these so-called weather patterns in the largest sense. Why all the cloud formation? Why we can't?
Well, and this, Marcia, gets us right to the latest thing that was posted on LaRouche Pack television last night, Cody Jones's new piece called To Be or Not to Be, That is the Galactic Question. And I would urge our listeners to watch that and get Cody's discussion of how what we're talking about is related to the move of our solar system into a northern plane of the galaxy and all that implies in terms of what we as a population have to do if we're going to survive. Now, Spencer, I'd like to get to the other side of this question that you brought up before when we were talking about creative destruction.
Mm-hmm.
What we see is as this food crisis is developing, as these earthquakes are taking place, as governments are going bankrupt, we have the ghouls of the environmentalist movement, led by this guy Schellnhuber, people like Holdren, the science advisor to President Obama, the so-called science advisor, who are essentially saying, well, the problem is that we have too many people, and we have to cut back, and we have to do away with modern technologies. We've been doing some work to expose this, but this is obviously a more serious threat than the galaxy.
Well, they definitely want to kill us off right away. And it's worse than evil, what they're proposing. And just reading the other day, some of our listeners might know the great poet Friedrich Schiller. He brings up a very great point in his essay, Of the Sublime, which is that he talks about preparing for natural disasters in this essay, and he says, mankind has the capability to build a dam to prevent floods, and we can build a ship to weather storms, and we could do these things, but that's not really anything unique. That's just, as a species, that's what, we live in certain areas, we have certain considerations in mind. That's what you do to survive. That's just thinking like in a certain philosophical point, that's sort of an animalistic thing to do. It's just a logical, rational thing you do.
Mm-hmm.
But, and whatever people think about how we are created or God or a Big Bang, whatever made us, the facts are there that we have a unique responsibility in the universe. We have a capability to know principles of how the universe works and act on it. We have a capability to go to other planets and spread the biosphere and spread creative life. And we have a responsibility to be the caretakers of the Earth that we've been given. And so thought about in that light, we have a responsibility, a joyous responsibility, to develop life. And we have a role as one of the main participants in extending creativity and developing the universe. Now, the environmentalists think just about the exact opposite, that we're here to destroy the universe. And all of our actions are geared towards that destruction. So we have to minimize our impact on this, what they say is otherwise beautiful universe that would be much better if we didn't exist in it. And it's just funny because that philosophical point drives everything else, where they think, well, we have to build solar panels and we can't develop nuclear power. We can't develop higher states of existence. We can't develop any sort of power in the universe more because we're evil. That's what they think.
Well, in a sense, it's ironic the way you were just posing it,
mm-hmm.
that they assert the law of entropy, or the second law of thermodynamics, so-called, mm-hmm. as principles. But in fact, it's the way they think that actually creates entropy among the human race.
Exactly. All of the so-called technologies they believe in are much worse than any of the technologies we have now.
And this is where you see Lyndon LaRouche's sense of urgency in saying, you must get Glass-Steagall now or mankind won't survive, because we won't survive the kind of hyperinflationary crash which is already underway.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Marcia, the implications of this then for food production, for just the disruption of life, it should be clear to people that there must be political action on this, and we see mass strike, elements of the mass strike all over the country. But what about in the Congress? I know you've been to some of the hearings recently. Deborah Freeman reported last week on this program that before the killing of Osama bin Laden, that it had become clear to many congressmen that they had to use last week's legislative session to address the destruction from the tornadoes and the flooding. And then in the aftermath of the stunt to kill Osama, none of that was discussed. What is the mood in the Congress right now to deal with these kinds of things?
Well, I think that the upwelling from the home districts, politically and physically, because the extreme weather and storms and everything we're talking about is creating conditions. I'll quote Kay Bailey Hutchison from Texas, Harley.
Yeah.
She said a week ago at a disaster preparedness hearing I happened to attend, she said, I don't know what this is all about. All I can say is it's more extreme than I've ever seen in my whole life. So this is not a philosophically deep woman here. But on the other hand, you get an element of reality, then I won't go into the rest of it. So you have an element of reality kind of flooding over the situation, and our own Glass-Steagall onslaught, call it that, is just critical, is what's bringing any reality into it, because by inclination, except for a few people who have introduced the Glass-Steagall, but, you know, and they're supporting it outright, most of the ranks of Congress is still reverting to type. They're cowardly and all the rest. No, they aren't speaking. But, on the other hand, the combination of the three things, I mean, the financial, the awareness of Wall Street and the speculation just taking over and shutting everything down, the physical crisis condition that's coming upon us, and then our own burn their butts effort, I think that's what is making all the difference.
Well, I can tell you from the standpoint of the LaRouche slate of candidates that we had a series of rallies the last couple of days, to highly visible rallies to mobilize people. We had a few more co-sponsors sign on this last week, including Congressman Lynn Woolsey from California, Jim McDermott from Washington State. There are a number of others who have promised. But look, that's six or seven co-sponsors out of a Congress of 435 people. And every single district in the country is hurting in one way or another. And it's clear that the president has made his decision that he's going to continue to support the bailout and support the banks over the people. And if you really read what Boehner and Sarah Palin and these others are saying, in a sense, their calls for budget cuts mean they're supporting the bailout also. So what Lyndon LaRouche has emphasized is if you're against the bailout and if you're for the survival of the United States as a sovereign nation, you have nothing to do except fight for Glass-Steagall. And that all we get otherwise in the form of excuses, we just have to say to people, you know, grow up, become an American citizen. And I think, Spencer, this is part of what we're trying to do with this series on the LPAC website that Obama is giving the Haiti treatment to the American people, is it not?
Definitely. I'd say just to add on that, I mean, even in the most literal sense, the Congress are representative of the population. So if we, you know, if everyone listening to this show is viewing themselves as political organizers, then it's up to us to act like the representatives and to fight to get our populations to put them on the hot, to put these reps on the hot spot and say, this is what has to happen. There's no more excuses. And that applies to everybody. That applies to the citizens. Say, this is your responsibility. They represent you. So if the population is going to act cowardly, then that's what they're going to do. And I think that's what our six LaRouche Democrat candidates typify. That they said, okay, there is no leadership coming from the Congress, so we have to do it. We have to step up. No one asked us. No one, we're not getting paid. We're not, you know, we don't have some title. But the role of leadership in this time needs to be filled, and they've done that. And that's exactly what's necessary. And that's, I think, some of, maybe Harley, you know more, but the response we've been getting in the field when we're politically organizing around the country is to that. It's not
about... when it's a clear message.
Yeah.
What I read you from Mr. LaRouche at the beginning of this program, you can't get more clear than that.
Mm-hmm.
He basically said, just to repeat this in case some people missed it or if they heard it but they weren't sure of what they heard, he said, anybody who is not for Glass-Steagall is either insane or incompetent. So we have to determine whether the whole Congress is insane or incompetent. If they are, then our job is straightforward. We've got to replace these guys as quickly as possible. And unfortunately, the 25th Amendment, while it applies to the president, doesn't apply to the whole U.S. Congress. But clearly, we have to take even the incompetent ones and teach them a lesson, that the American people are not going to tolerate the destruction of our nation. There's always this principle of justice and belief in progress in the United States, which is what's being attacked by these crazies like Schellnhuber. And Marcia, I'd like your thoughts on what you've seen from the Schellnhuber report, because this really does cohere exactly with the view that we should just let the rivers flow and let nature be nature.
Oh, yeah. And they use the expression sustainability and all this hokum, right? And we, speaking of the food situation, because, by the way, we didn't add on our list, we don't have to go through it all, but wheat, which isn't in the flood belt, it's in that drought belt. So Texas, Kansas is the great amber waves of grain state of the world. They have a disaster with the drought, with their winter wheat, along with Oklahoma. So, but it was a couple weeks ago when Prince Charles came to the United States in person representing this onslaught against humanity. And some of the major foundation wing of the kind of British Imperial Inter-Alpha group, that is the Bill Gates Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, they were all here in force in Washington, D.C., and they were all pushing on this side of Atlantic in the name of the food supply, what they called transformative agriculture. They issued reports on transformative agriculture. Charles met with, of course, Obama at the White House directly. And it's all really just saying any kind of parlor room names about sustainability, about transformation, about being friends of rural people, any kind of garbage. But it's for this point of the Schellnhuber report in Germany saying there's too many people in the world. We have to reckon the balance and eat less meat, produce less, use less resources. This is crazy. I'd like to throw in, this may be just to throw a sidelight on it, on some of the forebears of the characters like Schellnhuber and the, in other words, the fascist greenies in recent decades when it comes to flood control.
Sure, go ahead.
Let me give you an example, because if you take what we saw happen in Katrina with New Orleans, and they got rid of 100,000 people in New Orleans, right, Harley? Something like that. They had 400.
It may even be more than that, because a lot of the people who stayed initially have been forced to leave because there's no economy left there. But people don't realize that because of New Orleans is one of the big ports in the United States, and it had a number of chemical plants and other kinds of manufacturing plants that are related to shipping and transportation, which were flooded and never rebuilt.
And here's the pedigree of these people in just in one instance. In around 1964, the Army Corps of Engineers and the local entity relevant levee and flood protection entity of the city of New Orleans had a plan for wave surge protection wall. And they knew where they wanted to do it. They knew how they wanted to do it. So what happened? The environmentalist lawsuits were filed saying the impact had to be studied. You couldn't do it. Well, this wasn't filed because any of these environmentalists behind the lawsuit really thought anything one way or another. They just wanted to gum up the works. They wanted to delay everything. So the city of New Orleans said, we can't cope with this, even though the Army Corps said, no, go ahead, we'll litigate, we know we'll win, we often do. And they did sometimes. But the city of New Orleans said, we can't both pay for the law costs and hope to carry this through. We have to pull out. It was never built. Had that wall been built, and the plans were pretty well drawn up, there would not have been the damage of Katrina, because it was the surge that really did overtop and do all. There would still be damage, but not the catastrophe. And so that is in action what the Schellenhuber types are saying: don't build, die. Good that you're in harm's way. Let the disasters take over.
Well, what we're seeing, for example, the proposal that was made by the WBGU, the Schellenhuber Advisory Group, to the German government, which apparently, unless we can turn it around, the German government is going to adopt. They're talking about shutting down nuclear power plants in Germany by 2020 or 2021. They're talking about phasing out coal and other fossil fuels and going entirely to solar and wind. And I find it ironic that so-called greenies are going to pave over the beautiful green land of Germany to put in solar parks and windmills. So the hypocrisy there is quite extraordinary. And I know, Spencer, that you've been dealing with this when you were an organizer in Seattle, the Great Northwest, you know, where the people love to hug trees, but they also like to go back to their nice fancy apartments and cars. Although some of them, to be honest, some of them are true environmentalists who live in the woods and ride bicycles all the time. But how do you deal with this kind of insanity?
Well, I think our approach, at least on the webpage and in our organization, is to try to educate people about what it means to be a human being. the sort of what we've been talking about a little bit, that you don't have to adopt this pessimistic view that you're just a destruction on civilization and you're just wasting and yada yada. But the universe, whatever you believe, has given us a responsibility to develop the universe, to help. You know, we could actually create new planets. Let's put it that way. We could be mining the moons of Saturn for newer resources that would ironically make our footprint on the Earth almost nothing, as if they were even a bad thing. But to give people a sense that human beings are much more than just some physical entity that we're just here to procreate and to eat and to be wasteful, but we have a soul and we have an ability to be beautiful, creative creatures. And then I think that generally redefines how people see themselves. They don't think that we're just a waste, that God had some sick joke to make us just to destroy the universe, something like that.
Well, this is the subject of a number of recent papers by Lyndon LaRouche.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's, again, look, the basic point is your tools for this fight, and I'm talking to our listeners now, are on our website. In terms of the longer, full-length feature papers by LaRouche on this question that Spencer just brought up, what it means to be human. How does the human mind function so as to reflect the higher principles of the creative process of the development of our universe? And in that sense, why can we say confidently that the universe wants us to be creative? In fact, the universe has a need of man to be creative. We represent a completely new geological reality on the face of not just our planet, but within the galaxy. And so these kinds of questions that will define the next 50 to 100 years, the next 3 to 4 generations' activity, are already being discussed, not just by Mr. LaRouche, but they're up on our website. And, for example, Ouyang's piece on the Hypersea, what Cody just did, the work that Sky Shields has been doing with Lyndon LaRouche on the Weekly Report. So these are the tools that you have to be able to take on the insanity in the population. And as Marcia said earlier, reality is on our side. Reality is showing people that our negligence is what's causing the problem. So don't feel as though you're being victimized by some powerful force, all-powerful force of nature or of the oligarchy. You victimized yourself by tolerating the lower conception of what it means to be human. And so, Marcia, as we look at the what can be done right now, what can people do? Obviously, get Glass-Steagall in. Now, what else should be done to deal with these crises?
Yes, as I said, yes. Well, we're talking about raising the roof here. And the I'll give you one example. One of the western part of West Virginia flows into the Ohio River mostly. And so it was flooded. The Army Corps impounded all the water they could to hold it back, you know, as long as they could till the Ohio started going down. So one of the state legislators there this week, named Mr. Ronald Walters, he sent what he did about the whole flood disaster and everything else, sent a letter to the senators, to Rockefeller Mansion, to all the congressmen, and saying you have to pass Glass-Steagall. He's made that available and released it generally. And that's just one instance, which, if multiplied, I mean, we're talking about ourselves doing this. He's not some different person or something. But people, this, the self-evidence that people are human and they don't have to be washed away in a flood is occurring to millions of people. And I'll give two more examples. In 30 states of the country, you have different farmers active in what's called the National Farmers Union. It's been around since 1906. Right. Many of them had their march, this is before all the big storms, had their March National Convention reiterate that they want Glass-Steagall. You see what I mean? It's already there. Just like the International Association of Machinists, another absolutely hardcore, vital part of our nation's productive capacity. They are on record for Glass-Steagall. But it's every individual citizen, as you say, everyone listening here, uncles, cousins, brothers, you know, enemies, even neighbors and friends, have to enforce it. I couldn't think that we're in a bigger potential shift period that, as I say about it, it's self-evident to millions more people. Look at the 2.5 million or almost 3 million who live in the state of Mississippi. You mentioned that, Harley. You were in that neck of the woods.
Yeah.
That they had all their northern counties were hit by a supercell tornado. The village of Smithfield disappeared. All their southern counties are still hit by the flood wave of Katrina, which was really like the tsunami in effect, except there were no pictures of it because you couldn't take them during the storm. And now their Mississippi River counties are all hit. Those are 2.8 million people. It's gone. So there's nothing except what we're doing in the largest sense of a new understanding of what it means to be human, namely the natural environment is man-made, and enforcing it. That's what I think the specifics about the absolutely agriculture replanting, absolutely 100% rebuilding credits for all of this. This will flow from the Glass-Steagall as a disaster response.
And it will create the millions of jobs that Obama is not concerned about. Spencer, we have about a minute. What can we expect from LPAC TV in the next days?
Well, we're going to have a piece coming out very soon on the Cascadia Subduction Zone, which is in this series, as I mentioned earlier, about the disaster zones. We have a very humorous piece that it's called Glass-Steagall the Hard Way, and it's a little skit, just to give people a little sense, a little skit with President Obama and what happens to people that think it'll be okay, that Obama will figure it out.
All right. Well, that's something for people to look forward to.
Yeah.
I think if you took away his teleprompter, you'd see the kind of floundering that I think we're going to show on that. But in any case, Spencer and Marcia, thank you very much. We've pretty much run out of time here on the program today. This will be available if you want your friends to listen to it. It's archived on LaRouchePub.com. And make sure that you make as your homepage LaRouchePack.com so that you can pick up every single day the new postings that we're putting up from Percival, Virginia. So thanks for joining us, and we'll be back with you next week for The LaRouche Show.